Hello, everyone, and welcome on this cold, cold afternoon. Thank you for coming. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce Blythe, Dr. Blythe Corbett. And Blythe is visiting here from a warmer climate, slightly warmer anyway. Blythe is currently associate professor at the Mind Institute at UC Davis, and she is engaged in a number of different fascinating projects and research studies related to autism spectrum disorders. Blythe is finishing up a Kay Award looking at neuroimaging studies with a focus on the amygdala in persons with autism spectrum disorder. And the thing that I find really marvelous about the work that you do is that it's decidedly translational, and particularly looking at social emotional functioning and looking at biomarkers of social emotional status in youth with autism. We've kept you busy these last 2 days, but we did give you dinner last night. So without any further delay, Blythe, thank you for being here.
So I'll just introduce you briefly to my lab. It's called the Social Emotional Neuroscience Lab. And I'm really proud of this logo right here. This was actually created by one of my patients who, upon graduating art school, getting an AA, he created that for me. So I'm really thrilled with it. So what I mean by social behavior and what we study, we use standardized protocols to some degree in the lab. You might recognize this. This is the Trier social stress test. But we also look at much more relevant paradigms to include ecologically valid interaction paradigms, like this one takes place on a playground, and I'll present some of those data for you today. We also look at the perception and expression of emotion, and we study probably at the cornerstone of a lot of my work is really looking at salivary cortisol, both in terms of rhythmicity, the diurnal regulation, stress reactivity. We'll talk a little bit about individual differences here, and then how that might correlate with other aspects to include imaging data. So if we're all ready, we'll take a little journey here. So we would call that non-biological motion. For those of you who are in journal clubs today. And that sound effect, of course, was from my 13-year-old son. Okay, so the feeling was like a constant feeling of stage fright all the time. When people ask me what it's like, I say, just imagine how you felt when you did something really anxiety-provoking, such as your first public speaking engagement. Now, just imagine if you felt that way most of the time, for no reason. I had a pounding heart, sweaty palms, and restless movements. Well, this quote comes to us from none other than perhaps one of the best-known adults who happens to have an autism spectrum disorder. This is Dr. Temple Grandin, who's provided a lot of insights into what it's like to have this disorder. And even though she's made many gains, she's been very accomplished and achieved academically a prestigious career, one of her prevailing complaints, in addition to sensory sensitivity, is tremendous stress and anxiety. So in addition to the classic triad of impairments to include poor reciprocal social interaction, difficulty and deficits in verbal and nonverbal communication, and a repertoire of restricted, repetitive, and stereotyped behavior, many individuals with autism spectrum disorders also suffer from paralyzing anxiety and tremendous stress. And in fact, Leo Kanner, who was the first to really describe what we now think of as autism, also characterized in some of his earliest descriptions, although it's not part of our diagnostic criteria. So some of the reasons that we might want to look at one of the primary stress systems known as the limbic, hypothalamic pituitary, or LHPA axis in autism is, in addition to stress and anxiety consistently reported in many individuals with autism, it's also been shown that they have increased sensitivity to both the social and non-social environment. I'll be presenting a fair amount of data today to support that. We also know from both animal, non-human primate and primate research that psychosocial stress is a potent activator of this system. Furthermore, Stress and its biological consequences are often associated with the onset as well as the maintenance of many neurodevelopmental and psychiatric disorders. So this provides many reasons and a good platform why we might want to look at this in autism. One of my primary mentors and incredible influence in my work, Dr. Seymour Levine, is quoted in an extensive analysis of the psychological factors that regulate the LHPA axis. It's been hypothesized that neuroendocrine activation of this system can best be described as a response to uncertainty. So for all of you who work with this population, know that many of our kids and adults with autism respond poorly to novel situations and changes in their environment. So this provides yet another reason to explore this. So this is a schematic of what we often refer to as the neuroendocrine cascade and some of the brain structures that are involved within the system. So if we have a situation that is novel or violates our expectations, a number of brain structures are brought online to include the amygdala, which can provide the emotional salience to the event, the prefrontal cortex, this can provide a social context, among other things, the hippocampus, often implicated in memory. If the system is activated, it releases GABA, which acts on glucocorticoid receptors in the hypothalamus. This then releases corticotropin releasing factor and arginine vasopressin acting on the pituitary for the release of ACTH, which then acts on the adrenal for the release in humans of cortisol. This then acts like a negative feedback system. So once activated, kind of like the home thermostat, which is probably the best analogy, it then activates these, goes back to the glucocorticoid receptors to then deactivate the system. So a classic homeostatic loop. So cortisol, I'm sure most of you know, it's a classic biological marker of stress, but it's also a good index of our diurnal regulation. We know that elevations occur in response to novel situations. So cortisol, although it's found in blood, one of the really wonderful things about it, too, is it is found in saliva. So it allows us to do non-invasive sampling in many of our kids. We can find changes in saliva approximately 20 minutes after a stressor. So for example, if we were to suddenly experience some very stressful event in 20 minutes, if I was to take a sample from you all, I'd be able to detect whether or not you, biologically anyway, determined that particular event to be stressful. So I'm going to briefly go through a number of papers that have come out of my lab, and we'll summarize just some of these findings, and then we'll move on to some of our more recent work. So in general, we look at kind of three different areas of functioning to include rhythmicity, where we're evaluating the diurnal regulation of cortisol. We look at reactivity, where we look at cortisol in response to some type of social or non-social stressor. And we also look at this component of variability, which we find consistently in our data, at least in our children with autism. I'm not going to be really spending any time looking at diurnal rhythmicity today, but we can talk about it at the end in the discussion section of the presentation. But I just want to point out one thing. This is a group of children, 22 in each group in your right panel here. These are typically developing children. And this is what we want to see in terms of the regulation of cortisol. We want to see this nice peak in the morning, rapid decline throughout the day, and a lowest point in the evening, or what's known as the nadir. So this is over 6 days, so morning on each of these, and we want to see this really nice rhythm. On your left panel, these are 22 children with autism, high-functioning autism, 8 to 12 years of age, and as you can clearly see, there's a big difference between these two groups. Although the children with autism do have a rhythm in general, there's a lot of variability between the groups, but also within the group. And if this was in color, you'd be able to appreciate that even within individual subjects from day to day, for some of our kids, there's a lot of variability. This is something that we're looking at very carefully and trying to find correlates related to that. But we're going to focus now on just looking at responsivity, this idea, and variability. So we have different protocols that we use for each of the studies, but all of the kids get an ADOS, semi-structured standardized interview, and based in play. The parents fill out the stress survey schedule, which is a parent questionnaire that was designed expressly for autism and related neurodevelopmental disorders, and then the short sensory profile. We also oftentimes look at other things, but at least these are consistent across all the studies I'll talk about. The primary age that I look at are children 8 to 12 years of age. One of the reasons that it's such a restricted age range is I don't want to be getting into puberty, because then we've got a variety of things we have to consider when we look at hormones. And we also put a fair number of our kids in scanners. And so that's why we stop at kind of the 8-year-old limit. We also use children in our studies that are classically defined autistic disorder and are high functioning, meaning usually an IQ greater than 80. Our neurotypical peers are very well characterized to make sure that they truly have typical development, and we rule out other factors such as ADHD or whatever that might be in either their presentation or their family. And currently, the studies I'll be presenting are all male subjects. This is our general stress protocol. And so we'll take an initial salivary sample upon arrival to our site. We also call this acclimation, because it's not the second that they step out of the car, but usually they've gotten into the building. We take them to a calm waiting room and that sort of thing. So it's within about 15 minutes of their arrival. Then whatever stress protocol that we expose our kids to, 20 minutes later, we take a sample, and then 40, and then at 60 minutes. So one of our first studies was looking at a non-social stressor, which is a mock MRI scanner. We conceived of this primarily. My mentor had done a lot of work in mouse models and conceived of this as a great model for physical restraint as well as kind of noxious stimuli. And the child is still, just like in the real scanner, they're required to remain still, and their movement is monitored. So I don't know how many of you have actually kind of had the great experience of being in a mock MRI, but just in case you're curious, you can kind of see what our kids get exposed to. It'll come on, hopefully, in a moment.
Okay, how's it going? You all right? All right, cool. Okay, so we're going to move you in now. Here we go. Okay, stay nice and still.
So they're going into the bore.
All right, AMI. Here we go. We're going to play some sounds for you now, okay?
Yeah,
I know. These are like the sounds you're going to hear in the real MRI. Okay, here we go.
It's usually louder than that. Okay, we'll go on. All right, it's usually louder. We do protect their ears. They do have earplugs, and they often, in the real scanner too, we talk to them, so they have headphones on as well. But anyway, it's not the most pleasant experience. But anyway, so this is from one of our first studies. As you can see here on the x-axis, this is time, log salivary cortisol on the y-axis. The typically developing children are presented here with this triangle, and the children with autism, the squares. As you can see, their arrival time is generally comparable. The typically developing children did not show a significant stress response. In fact, there was actually a diminution here. In contrast, many of our children with autism showed a significant rise in salivary cortisol in response to this non-social stressor. One thing I will point out, however, there was a lot of variability. Those that did have a response, it was rather prolonged. And in this study, we also sampled them from home, but it was back to basal levels by the time they got back home. So from that study, we were curious. First of all, we wanted to see if we would replicate it with a much larger sample. But in addition, we wanted to see, okay, so what happens if we brought them back? You know, would they habituate? Would they show a reduced response, which is what this model would show? In other words, if they show a lot of stress on the first exposure, then what happens on the second? Would it go down? That was one idea. Or, in contrast, upon re-exposure, it could be a sensitization model where they would have a significant increase. We were predicting the former, that they would habituate. So first of all, as happens in research, even though many of our children did not show a significant rise in salivary cortisol, it did not reach statistical significance for this study. However, our prediction of habituation also was not, the data was quite different. The fascinating thing, though, although we showed sensitization, it was not in response to the actual mock or MRI, which would have been right here. It was actually just walking in the MRI environment. And it wasn't just children with autism. In fact, it was our typically developing children as well. So this was really quite remarkable, and it really lends itself to this idea of anticipatory stress. And although we think, many of us anyway, as psychologists, that maybe we should be preparing our children for some of our medical procedures, I don't know, but this data suggests that maybe we shouldn't tell them too much or expose them at a time, then maybe we should just, you know, bring them in, put them in the scanner, and yeah, and there we go. But anyway, this was really quite a very interesting finding. I think over time, after subsequent exposures, likely it would go down. We have data to support that that's not out at this time. The other thing, like I said, that we look at is variability, as well as differences within our groups. You know, anyone who works with children in general, but especially in autism spectrum disorders, knows there's a really heterogeneous group of kids. And so now what we're doing is looking at differences in terms of their cortisol responsivity. And so we're separating the groups now, and that's what this particular graph just shows, is that our groups generally break out in these different categories. So we have autism responders and typical responders, as well as non-responders across both groups. And we're starting to associate these to different types of social and non-social correlates. So in general, some of the clues into the rhythms and reactions of our kids with autism is that we do seem to be finding these subgroups, as I just explained. The one thing I really want to emphasize is that the behavior does not necessarily map onto the biology. In fact, many of our children with autism, when we were putting them, for example, in the scanner, they looked just fine. And in fact, I can remember calling up my colleague, Gake Levine, and saying, you know, I don't know if this is the best paradigm, because they're getting in, they're coming out, and they're looking pretty good. And then we saw the data, you know, it was really quite striking. The other thing is this idea of repeat exposure is, I think, a model that we should continue to pursue, because maybe this idea of exposing children to procedures may not be the best idea for some of the kids, although a stress response is adaptive to have increased cortisol in some situations can be adaptive. But we do also know that increased reactivity over time can also have deleterious effects as well. The other thing it suggests, this anticipatory stress, suggests that there clearly are, as we know from other models, psychological processes are at work. And so they seem to be at work in our children with autism, at least high functioning. It sort of lends itself for this idea of intervention that maybe approaches like cognitive behavior therapy would be continue to be beneficial for these children. So more and more, my work is getting more into using paradigms that mirror the real world of some of our kids, and in particular, the social functioning of our kids. And we know that social factors can induce, they can enhance, or they can diminish the stress response in primates. We know that our children with autism, that just by developing or having experiences in the social world can increase their insight into their own social functioning. And for many of our kids with autism, it's been proposed anyway, that this might actually, in and of itself, increase their anxiety in social situations due to repeat failure, not understanding the expectations in the social world. So for a variety of these reasons, you know, a lot of my work now is not only looking at stress, but in particular, in the social realm. As I mentioned, we do look at more standardized procedures. Some of you might recognize that this is the Trier social stress test. And these are my research assistants. They really are very friendly, but in this particular paradigm, they're supposed to look neutral. And the children come forward as in the standard test, and they have to complete a particular speech that they have been introduced to in an exciting and wonderful way, and they're told that they will be compared to other children. And it really is very difficult to be doing anything in front of people who are not giving you effective feedback. And this is a classic stressor for adults, because this is Kimberly, this is her dissertation, actually. I won't tell you the results of it because she's writing them up right now, but this has been reported by Janssen and others in autism, and we're contributing to that growing literature. So now I'm going to present to you a new paradigm that we've developed, which we just simply refer to as the peer interaction playground paradigm. It's more ecologically valid, and it was designed to try to emulate the real world of some of our kids during play. In contrast to a lot of studies of stress where they are actually trying to solicit a stress response, we are actually trying to use this paradigm to put children in a rather benign social situation, just playing in a playground, and asking the question, is this in fact stressful? We specifically do not force the interaction with the children. There's no evaluative threat like there is in the Trier social stress test, and there isn't any peer rejection either. We know that all of those components can activate the LHPA axis. We're intentionally not doing that in this study. So our paradigm includes three children. We have a child with autism, we have a typically developing child, and then we also have a same age, same gender confederate. This is a child who actually works with the research team, and we have three that we actually work with. And we try to the best of our ability match them up by size too, because as many of you know, especially when you get to the 12-year-olds, the size differential can be quite extraordinary, but it doesn't always work out that way, but we do our best. Each child is provided with a fanny pack that contains a small battery-powered microphone that's then subsequently clipped to the shirt, kind of like mine. And each device is recorded onto a separate channel on a sound mixer that's inside the building. Our confederate also wears a small headphone, a bug in the ear. This allows us to directly communicate with the confederate when he's out on the playground. So these are pictures describing what I was just talking about. So this is the playground, and this is our confederate. And what he's doing there is clapping, because we're just trying to sync the visual and the sound, because we actually have four cameras going simultaneously. We have two on the building that are remotely controlled inside, and then two, for example, that's me just operating one of them. And then here's David, one of my research assistants, who's talking to our confederate on the playground. So the interaction takes 20 minutes. It's divided into 4 5-minute segments. During the first period is free play. This is where all three children just come out to the playground at the same time, and they can just engage in independent gross motor play. The second period is one of the ones we're particularly interested in. This is where the confederate is prompted to elicit an interaction with both of the children to engage in some kind of gross motor play. He's asked to play with them, but not get too physically active on the playground, because we also know that exercise can also activate the LHPA. The third period, he's instructed to kind of casually just sort of walk away, not to be rude or anything like that, but just again, kind of walk over. This is the same time we bring out a box of toys that lend themselves to cooperative play. These have balls in them and other things, and there's always three. During this fourth period is when the confederate once again is prompted to solicit interaction with the toys and the two peers. We make up to three attempts for him to try to get both children to participate with him. After that, the child is just left alone. In terms of the behavior analysis, we take two forms. Classic treatment in terms of looking at frequency data, duration, and directionality. But we also use what's called the transactional approach, otherwise known as who does what to whom format, with a predefined list of behaviors. A lot of this work was established with non-human primates. This allows us to look at social interaction in a more dynamic way, which we think is more appropriate to really understanding what's going on in terms of, you know, our children with autism. So this is an example of the playground, and in this case, three different views. And this is a very brief vignette, but I'll also say it was a windy day that day, so this sounds not that great, but at least it gives you a visual of a prompting for our Confederate.
Do you want to play on that side? It's pretty far.
Yeah, I've seen that kind of... I've seen that kind of slide. Sometimes it's not fun, sometimes it is.
Okay.
Where do you go to school?
What he's referring to is it's a bumpy slide. Yeah, sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's not. So, so that's just an example of when the prompting. And then this is just another example. We've brought out a box of toys subsequently. And so the Confederate's prompted again.
I've never seen these before.
Oops, sorry. Let me go back to that. Yikes. There we go. I don't know why it's not working. Sorry. Let me just give you one. There's. Yeah. There we go. And go.
I've never seen these before.
You want to play with us?
No.
Okay.
So he.
Do you think there are supposed to be two for every player?
So that's what we would call thwarting, okay? Yeah, thwarting the social interaction efforts. So these behaviors are coded in many different ways, and for some reason this isn't switching. Okay, I don't know why. No. So, frozen screen. So, maybe we'll do page down. Okay, I don't know. Okay, while we're waiting for the screen to unfreeze, let me just... Actually, here we go. Sorry. I hit escape. When all else fails in life, hit escape. Okay, so this is the timeline peer interaction that we just described right here, the 20 minutes. So as I already talked about, we have a sample here, then we have, again, 20-minute sample, 40-minute, and then this 60-minute. And this is just a screen format. You can see the NOLDIS. When we're coding, there's three different screens we can look at that we sync together, and there's a number of different things that are coded throughout, and each child is coded. We have verbal bouts, we do frequency, et cetera. So just kind of give you a heads up on some of the results that we have so far. We have 21 children with autism, 24 typical children. We couldn't include data on some of the kids. It was not usable. We had, for example, significant differences for interaction between the groups in terms of the children with autism, not surprisingly, had fewer interactions for both the motor, that's the second time period, and the cooperative play time period. These results are comparable to Hawk and Fine. In their 95 paper, where again, they use kind of a more socially relevant paradigm. We also, before I move on to that, we also are looking in a much more refined way of other things like proximity, equipment use, and so on, and seeing whether or not these are distinguishing not only between children with autism and typically developing kids, but which we find even more interesting is within the autism group, we're definitely finding differences as well. So in terms of salivary cortisol, this graph doesn't represent the data that well because, again, it's not showing the variability. But in short, when we look at the mean, our children with autism represented here, they are showing a significant rise in salivary cortisol in comparison to our typically developing children. But like I said, we're especially interested in looking at within group differences. And so in some of our more recent work, we have this concept of responders and non-responders. And so on your x-axis here on your left, this is responder status, right, non-responder. And then here, this is one particular behavioral index, which is called equipment use. And as you can see in the autism group, which is represented here by the dark line, typically developing children here, there was a significant difference in salivary cortisol, which means our responders, for equipment use. In combination with some of our other findings, what this is suggesting to us is that these are children that are not completely avoidant, not the ones that are over in the corner avoiding all interaction, which we have those too. These are the kids that are kind of doing what we used to call parallel play. Some of our kids, I'm now calling this sort of peripheral play. They're engaging to some degree. They don't initiate, but they will, you know, respond to the other kids sometimes. They also do a lot more what we call walk-bys. This is where they kind of go by, which we see a lot in non-human primates, which is why we started looking at this. The other thing I neglected to point out also is in this data here, there was a significant interaction between diagnosis and age for salivary cortisol. So the children with autism who also showed increased cortisol, these were the older kids. So one would think maybe, well, wouldn't older kids, you know, have less stress response? But that kind of goes back to what we were talking about, maybe gaining more insight, realizing that they're different, maybe trying a little bit harder, but not quite knowing what to do, and that sort of thing. So there seems to be these relationships between stress response and age, and stress response and their level of social engagement. The other thing that we're looking at, we only have a little bit of data so far, but we're also looking at another neuropeptide, another hormone, oxytocin, and we're looking at the relationship ultimately in salivary cortisol. And this is a collaboration with Sue Carter, Suma Jacob, Karen Bales at UC Davis. We just have a little bit of data. This preliminary work suggests that at least there's a preponderance of children that seem to have lower levels of oxytocin as far as at baseline, but we have a lot more work to do, and there's a lot of variability. So we'll take a look at that. So another area that we're looking at is using imaging, and in particular, looking at a brain structure called the amygdala. The amygdala is very involved, as many of you know, in the perception of emotion and social behavior, and also in the regulation and activation of the LHPA axis. So this is an example of some of the things that we're doing. This is a manual tracing protocol developed by Cindy Schumann, where we actually do tracing on the MRI of this structure. Several years ago, I wrote a paper with David Amaral where, kind of springboarding off Simon Baron Cohen's amygdala theory of autism, where we were proposing that if, in fact, the amygdala is implicated in autism, perhaps it's involved also in this stress responsivity or increased anxiety that we often find in many of our kids. And so that's what sort of got me interested when I went on to imaging to look specifically at that structure as well as others. So this is a paper that came out of my K Award and just came out this year. I won't, in the interest of time, go through this too much, but basically it was a basic block design where the child had to identify whether or not two images were the same feeling, whether or not they were the same thing, which is a control condition, whether or not they're the same person or the same type of thing. So there's kind of a categorical one at the end. And again, just to very briefly talk about some of our findings, is that what you're seeing in the panel over here, this is just a mask. We specifically wanted to look at the amygdala as one of the things we did in this. And so we looked at that. This here is an image of the typically developing group in a between group contrast. And they did engage the amygdala for this task. In contrast, our children with autism showed an absence or a significant reduction in this task. Now, the interesting thing, this was during the person contrast. This is where they had to match whether or not this person is the same or different. And it was to neutral faces. They also behaviorally had a significant challenge on this task, matching, is this the same person or are they different? They had a real hard time with that task. Interestingly, on the emotion matching task, they did all right behaviorally. But again, they showed there's the children with typical development to an area called the fusiform gyrus, which Bob Schultz and others have reported differences in terms of fusiform activation. In our kids, we did see some activation, but it was reduced on this task. But there was this real contrast in terms of behavioral response and a neural response. The other thing we looked at is, again, the volume or the size of the amygdala. There's been some reports to suggest that the amygdala may be larger, at least in some age groups of children with autism. So we wanted to look at that, and we looked at use Cindy Schumann's protocol because we wanted to use something consistent. And in fact, we had her check and recheck our reliability to just make sure that we were sticking really close to it. And we did not see significant differences in terms of the right or the left amygdala. However, I don't know, I doubt you can see it in the back of the room, but these are children with autism. On the right, over here, all these dots. There was a lot of variability, once again, you know, in our children. And because we're looking at variability in terms of cortisol responsivity, we also want to look at it here, and in terms of social anxiety. And one thing that we did find is there was this relationship between the children that actually had smaller amygdala associated with more anxiety. It's kind of went in a different direction than we expected. However, there are some recent reports in pediatric cases of just generalized anxiety and looking at amygdala volume, and they also reported a smaller amygdala. So it's a small sample, though, so it will definitely need to be replicated before we can make too much of it. This is some unpublished data. We also want to look at responder status here, and in terms of amygdala volume and cortisol, our kids showed increased responsivity, salivary cortisol to the mock MRI, also had a smaller amygdala. So again, it's a small sample size, but it is interesting. So now, just like in the peer interaction work cortisol, in the fMRI work, I'm more interested in using more socially relevant paradigms. And so the field of neuroeconomics is giving us a nice bridge into kind of looking at some of these kind of more interesting ways of looking at social cognition. And one of them is this game you might have heard of called Prisoner's Dilemma Game, which we've renamed to call it the Peer Interaction Game. It's really gambling for kids. So, and I got IRB approval for this, so. Anyway, it's been used in a variety of adult studies. Jim Rilling at Emory is really one of the big proponents of this paradigm, and in fact, it's his protocol that we're using. But it really allows us to also look at both social and non-social factors in these peer exchanges and behavioral responses. And because of the fact that they know that they're going to earn money, it also takes away that motivational factor. So anyway, this we've modified from the classic Prisoner's Dilemma to make it a little more user-friendly. When in doubt, bring in SpongeBob, you know? This is the practice paradigm. So this is when they're learning how to actually play the game. So you represents our participant that's in the scanner. And this is, in this case, SpongeBob or the partner, which I'll describe more in a moment. So they press either the one key or the two key. One is to cooperate. Two is to compete. So depending on whether or not you choose to cooperate and what your partner does depends on how much money you're going to earn. So in this case, you cooperated with SpongeBob and you got $2. Not bad. So the other interesting thing that we do is they actually get to play with a confederate that they met on the playground just 2 weeks before. In this case, this is our confederate, and so they get to play with him. So in this case, you would have competed and your buddy did not, and you got $3. The other half the time, you're not playing with the confederate men on the playground, you're playing with a computer. And this is at least what we tell the children. But in truth, they're always playing with a computer algorithm. And again, we got IRB approval for that. And we debriefed the kids afterwards to let them know that the whole time they really were playing with a computer. And this is the basic paradigm. There's a period of time in which they choose whether to cooperate or compete. Then there's a fixation, the outcome is revealed, another fixation, and then the next trial. And there's a total of 40 trials. I'll just briefly, these are the fMRI parameters for those who might be interested. But we'll go on to just some of the findings. And these are just when the results are revealed. So this is when the child discovers what his choice was in combination with the partner choice. So we so far have about 41 participants for the behavioral data. As any of you know who have done imaging, motion is a huge factor. So we've lost a fair number of kids to motion, but we still have 32 kids in our sample. So we have 15 with autism and 17 neurotypical kids. So we wanted to see whether or not there was a difference behaviorally and whether or not the children chose to cooperate or compete across the groups. And what we did find is there was a significant difference in terms of their strategy. And their children with autism competed less or cooperated more than the neurotypical children to a significant degree. And in fact, our neurotypical kids competed 81% versus children with autism, which is around 63%. Interestingly, though, there wasn't a significant difference in terms of partner type, so whether or not they played with a human versus a computer partner, which we had predicted that there would be a difference, but so far anyway in the sample we don't have it. Reaction time, we thought there might be a difference there too, but we didn't find it. And the money earned, again, no difference. And I can tell you, they all earned a lot of money. Yes, on average they earned about $40. Yeah, so. And I really wanted to give them real money, but the IRB wouldn't allow that. So we gave them gift cards from Target or wherever. So some of the findings that we have are really quite interesting. So this is a condition where both you as the participant and your partner chose to compete. So this is the DD condition, and where you are told that you're playing with the Confederate that you met on the playground. And a really interesting thing, this is an example of, there's a between group contrast, so comparing across the groups. But what we're showing is that the neurotypical group activated the right superior frontal gyrus, bilateral anterior cingulate, and other areas that have been reported in some of the adult literature. But this was nearly absent or significantly diminished in most of our children with autism. Interestingly, take the same condition, is when both, there's mutual competition. This is now to the computer. And the children with autism, in contrast, engage the amygdala and others, what we would call social emotional brain regions, such as the ACC, superior frontal gyrus, which was activated for the last contrast for the computer condition when they thought they were being thwarted by the computer. So it's really quite remarkable. The findings suggest that they're either having an emotional response to this computer rather than the human partner, or alternatively, it may be the case that the differences may arise as a result of a failure to differentiate between partner type. So, and we're seeing the difference because they're becoming engaged for both the social human condition as well as the computer condition, but it's coming out in this contrast. So that's just some of the preliminary work we're doing. Our children with autism in general tend to show less brain activation overall. A neurotypical group is showing many prototypical brain regions being activated like we see in the adult literature. The autism group also shows greater activation compared to our neurotypical kids for these computer conditions. And they seem to, anyway, be recruiting these social, emotional type of brain regions for the computer. Or, like I already summarized, these regions may both be activated regardless of the social salience. So what do some of these findings suggest? And being a clinician, I always want to go back and say, what can we do with some of this information? Well, one of the ideas is that even very benign social and non-social situations may be stressful for many of our children with autism. So I think we really need to more and more be considering ways that we can ameliorate this stress. One way is obviously direct skills training. Many of our approaches don't consider stress. We're focused on social functioning and communication and so on, but I think we need to be thinking consciously about how stress fits into these pictures. We also want to create real world opportunities, you know, because even on the playground, we're seeing many of our kids are really having difficult times, so we need to kind of think in that context. Also, children with autism may not be differentiating between social and non-social stimuli, so what do we do with that? Well, one thing we might want to do is utilize a multimodal approach. We talked in the Autism Journal Club today a lot about, you know, using video versus live or in vivo type modeling, and yet in many cases maybe we should just be using both. And regardless of just trying to figure out what works best, just incorporate both. Also that the perception skills may be intact, but the integration and expression of these may not. So part of what we may be seeing, it's really not that they can't do the fundamental perceptual skills, but it's making sense of that. So for example, develop skills through action, through imitation, through practice, and then build on this for generalization. So before I go on to the final part of my talk, I want to acknowledge my team. So I have several people in my lab. Clayton Shoup is actually my graduate student. He's a statistician, and he does a lot of these much more complicated statistical approaches where we're using multi-level analysis. Niles Ryan and Kimberly Lonnie is another graduate student, and David Simon. But I also have several collaborators on the data that I presented today, to include Sally Mendoza, Cam Carter with the fMRI work, as well as Bookard Shipper, and of course, Sue Carter and Suma Jacobs. So I've shown that we do a number of things in the Sense Lab. We look at behavior, emotion, perception, expression, structural as well as functional MRI, and then look at how it relates to endocrine functioning. And we can't do any of the work without our children and families, especially some of the homework that we do, where they really are collecting data for us. And so we're really grateful for that. A lot of my work has been funded through the K Award, but I've also gotten departmental grants, as well as at the Mind Institute. Before I go on, though, and we wrap up into our discussion section, I want to share with you a very exciting project that I've started, which is called Sense Theater. It's actually a nonprofit theater program for children with autism. And basically, it's a unique intervention where it's also a research program, and it's designed to specifically target and hopefully improve the social and emotional functioning of children with autism and related disorders. And so I'm just going to leave you with this little video. 1 second, if I can find where my arrow is. There we go. And here we go.
Sense Theater was started with the idea that the theater is an ideal environment to teach a variety of skills that children with autism especially need to learn. So, for example, learning how to improve social skills, how to communicate not only verbally but through gesture, by expressing emotions, through movement. The theater, by nature, provides an opportunity to explore and to learn these various skills. So by teaming up children with autism with actors who are, shall we say, experts in social skills and verbal communication and expression, together, children with autism can learn from the masters of these behaviors. And that's exactly what we've done in Sense Theater. The children with autism are teamed up with actors who are already in the show, and they work with them not only at the theater, but also we videotape them doing their particular role, and then we broadcast this on the web, and they're able to practice from home with their parents or others the very roles that they then will be performing on the stage. We have seen amazing changes in them already. At first, a couple of them kind of tentative to come into the theater. It's rather stressful, a lot of stimulation going on, which a lot of children with autism don't like. But within a very short period of time, they already started really developing these nice relationships with their buddies, started singing along, and really being embraced and adopted by the theater company. I think that typically developing children, the actors are getting a lot out of this as well. They have clearly gained an appreciation of children with autism and neurodevelopmental disorders. I think many of them have taken a sense of pride in being a buddy and helping out and being co-actors with them. I think this is going to generalize to their school environment and out into the community, that they will be able to be much more sensitive and great little helpers in a variety of settings, everything from the shopping center to the classroom, being able to understand, have a little bit more patience for some of our kids. I think one of the most meaningful comments that I've heard about the program have come from the parents especially that are participating in the program. And it's not simply what changes that they're noticing in the theater, but what they're noticing outside in the real world. So they're seeing them go to classroom, be more interactive with other children. They're seeing them being less stressed and tentative in new situations. These are the things that we're really thrilled about with Sense Theater. You can never predict if that generalization is going to occur, but so far it looks like we are really making gains in ways that we didn't anticipate but we were hoping for. We've had a tremendous amount of interest in Sense Theater, not only the concept but the program. I'm hoping that we'll be able to take this on the road, so to speak, be able to reach out to other communities and other families and other groups that are interested in this, and be able to provide the same kind of opportunity to other children with autism and neurodevelopmental disorders. It's clear that the theater is a magical environment for our kids, and we're hoping to be able to reach out to many more so that they can benefit like many of our kids have in this production. So that's it.
So, really interesting talk, really interesting data. Your fMRI results, where you show the kids with autism have greater amygdala activation mm-hmm. to being beaten by a computer than by a peer. Do you debrief them afterwards to try and tease apart those possibilities that you talked about?
Yeah. So we also, what I didn't present today, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at this, as you can imagine. We also have them do emotion ratings. And so one of the interesting things is during that DD condition, as well as in the condition which is the CD, where they cooperate and the partner does not, in both of those, they tend to show a more negative response than the typically developing kids, but especially to the computer, or to both the computer and the human condition. Mm-hmm. So it suggests anyway that they really aren't differentiating. They don't like the competition. They don't like not winning. The typically developing children, although they didn't respond quite as negatively as we thought they might, to them, one of our interpretations of that was that they just look at it as a game. I mean, you know, they play so many video games, it's like, oh, I lost, okay, whatever. But their emotional reactivity, at least anyway, of our children with autism seems to be a little bit more extreme. So we have a lot more work to do on this, but it was really quite intriguing to have that pop out with the computer condition. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Right. And I wonder if you would just share a little bit of that. I know you don't have, it's preliminary, but it's really exciting.
Yeah. So I didn't present the actual data. It's currently under review. But these kids were assessed pre-post with neuropsych measures such as the NEPC, for those of you that are familiar with that. And they got cognitive testing pre-post. But we also looked at salivary cortisol, both at home as well as
at the first rehearsal, mid-rehearsal, and last rehearsal. And not so surprised. Actually, you know what? I'll just go ahead and show you. Whatever. I think it's here. Okay, so I'll come back to that. Okay, so here's actually the data for salivary cortisol. So on your left, in the blue, this is the beginning of the first rehearsal. And these are children with autism. And then this is the post. So that's a couple hours, that's 2 hours later. So you can see this was a significant difference in terms of salivary cortisol. This arrival time, too, is significantly higher than our afternoon cortisol samples as well. Because like I said, we do take a lot of home sampling, too. I don't have the mid sample here, but compared to the final rehearsal, as you can clearly see, there's no stress reactivity, at least in terms of cortisol, in terms of their arrival times, and no difference in terms of the post-rehearsal. So at least, this is only, you know, 8 children, so to be able to show statistical differences is kind of, you know, pretty remarkable. But nonetheless, it suggests anyway that these kids are also not only behaviorally, but in terms of biologically adapting, you know, to the environment. We don't show differences in the home, but we do show differences also at midpoint as well, again, going in this direction. And then we also, in terms of neuropsych functioning, as far as pre-post testing, this is the NEPSI for some of you that are familiar. This is a matching task for faces, and we're showing a significant difference from pre-post on that measure. Affect recognition was not statistically significant, but it's going in the right direction. And then theory of mind also, which is in the red columns, showed a statistically significant difference from pre-post as well. The interesting thing about this is we're not actually targeting that in the intervention. So we're not teaching them how to specifically recognize faces. We're certainly not teaching theory of mind. But just over a couple month period of time, there was a significant change in their level of functioning, at least on these particular measures. So those are some of our data. It's very preliminary, obviously, but it's encouraging. It's going in the right direction. So.
And how many productions?
So this is our first one, but just Saturday we had our auditions for our next production. And we're doing Wizard of Oz. And we are going to have 15 children on the autism spectrum on the stage in a cast of about 40. And it's pretty exciting. It's pretty chaotic. We're all volunteers. So, and our volunteers consist of 2 behavioral pediatricians, a geneticist, 2 psychologists, 4 behavior specialists. It's a pretty, you know, impressive team. And then lots of parents, as you can possibly imagine. But it's really fun. And, you know, the worst thing that can happen is the kids get on stage and make new friendships. So the typically developing kids are extraordinary. And these are actors who are saying, you know, I don't care if I have a role or not. I just want to be there. It's quite remarkable. So it's very fun. Any other questions? Or? Absolutely, yeah, if you want to.